This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
And we come to lecture 16. And I want to very briefly lay out different approaches to the law. And we are sweeping with broad strokes, as you will see, because the first approach to the law puts together dispensationalists and Lutherans. They have a lot that they don't agree on, but in terms of their view of the law, there are some similarities. So we are painting with a broad brush here, and then we want to develop what we call a Christocentric view of the law and give you some examples as to how that would work out, and then that'll set us up to work our way through the book of Leviticus. And there'll be time in the book of Leviticus to sort of talk about how some of these things relate to us today and what do you do with the law. So very briefly, the dispensational Lutheran approach. This approach stresses discontinuity between the Mosaic law and the New Testament believer. The Mosaic law is given to Israel for a limited period of time, a limited purpose, and is no longer immediately authoritative for the Christian. This view assumes a law is not in force from the Old Testament, a law from the Old Testament. It assumes a law is not in force unless specifically mentioned in the New Testament. So usually the Sabbath commandment, they will argue, has very little relevance to God's people today. Generally, this view, especially the Lutherans, stress the function of the law that brings conviction of sin, what we call the second use of the law. The other approach I briefly want to mention is theonomy. And I've got some names in your notes associated with theonomy. Rush Dooney, he has died. Bodson, he has died. Gary North is still alive. If you hear the term Reconstructionist, that is a term that usually is associated with theonomy. This approach stresses continuity between the Old Testament law and the New Testament believer, so that the Old Testament law carries a universal obligation. The key text, one of the key texts, and we can turn there very briefly, is Matthew 5, 17 through 19. And the chapter title of, one of the chapter titles in Bonson's book is The Abiding Validity of the Law in Exhaustive Detail. Now, verse 17 of Matthew 5, I do not think I came to destroy the law or prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Jesus did not come to abrogate the law, but he came to fulfill the law. And in their understanding, fulfill means to confirm and restore in full measure. That's how they would define fulfill, to confirm and restore in full measure. Not much advancement related to the law in that definition. Now, verse 18 strengthens the teaching of verse 17 by giving the reason of verse 17. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Jesus, they would say, could not invalidate the law because the law remains binding until the end of the world, until the consummation. And the precise details are as important as the general principles, every jot and tittle. So, quoting here, from Bonson. He who believes the Word of God must affirm its precise contents, and he who follows the Christian ethic must seek to observe the full and exact details of God's law. And then they talk about verse 19 in terms of sanctification. Now, the principle that they operate on is we must presume that the law of the Old Testament has abiding validity and is relevant for God's people today. Now, where the rubber meets the road relates to the judicial laws of the Old Testament. The judicial laws of the Old Testament should be the basis of civil law and civil government, including the penalties of the Old Testament law. And therefore, the following crimes should receive a death penalty. And again, I'm quoting. Murder, adultery and unchastity, sodomy and bestiality, homosexuality, rape, incest, incorrigibility in children. Sometimes you feel like killing them, don't you? Sabbath breaking, kidnapping, apostasy, witchcraft, sorcery, and false pretensions to prophecy and blasphemy. All of those should receive the death penalty through the civil government. We'll make one more comment and then I'll get your question. They also say that the law of God must not be imposed by force on an unwilling society. And this sort of fits into their, to many of them who hold to a post-millennial eschatology, that the gospel will so transform culture that societies will want this the law of God to be implemented along with these penalties. So they don't necessarily think you should impose this. Now, whether all their followers follow that might be another thing. But yes, you had a question.
Enforce these laws, the church,
civil magistrates.
Okay, so they believe there should be like Christian nations.
I don't know if they would use that terminology per se, but civil magistrates who are believers, because society has been transformed by the gospel, will be those who would implement these type of laws. Yes.
When Dr. Bonson was first asked that question, I was in the first class he taught at RTS. Mm-hmm. When he was asked that question, his response was, you have to have a Christian world like you, and we have to raise up generations of Christians who go into politics and go into every other sphere of society. And when they grow into politics, they'll take with them into politics the these principles.
Right.
And then an educated group of individuals within the United States will exercise their authority at the voting booth to see that these principles get put into place. So that was his concept of how it worked, at least in the beginning. I don't know how it was towards the end.
Which sort of relates to the idea that there will be this transforming effect of the gospel as a biblical world in life you grow. Yeah.
My question is, how do you gauge the willingness of society just as a majority of goals? Nigeria or Sudan, and at what point will it be the majority want tribal law?
I don't know the answer to those questions. I mean, perhaps the answer that was just given would answer your question. It's the development of a biblical world in life view that begins to change people and families as we are faithful in passing that on, and then that would have an effect. Now, they do. Yes. Well, that's an interesting question. Recently, Bonson had a lot to do with it.
But, you know, you go back before the Reformation and you read some of John Knox's sermons, and, you know, they're calling for theocracies. So there's a part of this before the Reformation where they did not have a clear concept of a separation between the civil authorities and the church. And in fact, for a period, they could not conceive of a territory having more than one church. So you had the Catholic territories and the Protestant territories. And so you may even go back to Constantine if you can do some of this. So, not necessarily, yes. Now, they also say that there are miscontinuities to take into consideration concerning the law. And some of these discontinuities are redemptive historical, but they revolve around the redefinition of the people of God. So that what God was doing with the nation of Israel was only a type, looking forward to what he would do with the church. And so because of the redefinition of the people of God in the new covenant, we no longer as the church defend God's kingdom with the sword. We no longer have to be politically loyal to Israel. The provisions tied to the land in the Old Testament we don't have to be concerned about, and certain laws which symbolically taught Israel to be separate from the Gentile world, like the food laws, we don't have to follow. Now, Poitras, a section of Poitras that I have you read, interacts with theonomy, and he shows a lot of the positive things, but then he also has some negative evaluations. And let me just say a few words here. The way they set up their own program, stressing the exhaustive details of the law, sort of sets them up for, you know, why are they now allowing changes of the law in terms of some of these things I've just mentioned. Let me come back to that in a second. The meaning of the word fulfill, plerao, it's not just to confirm and restore in full measure. There is an advancement of the law in terms of the fulfillment that takes place in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ teaches what the law really means to his contemporaries. You can see that in Matthew 5. You've heard what it was said. Your oral tradition has interpreted the law this way, but I'm telling you, this is what the law really meant. This is what the law says. And in his fulfillment of the law, he advances aspects of the law, so that the law is not the same after the coming of Jesus Christ. It takes on new significance. And obviously we could talk about the Sabbath commandment. We don't worship on Saturday, we worship on Sunday because of what Jesus did. So there is an advancement related to the law. Yes?
How did they deal with Jesus and the chief of the adulterous woman? They're the you're trying to celebrate that you have about some text or stuff. How do they deal with something like that with these women?
I don't know specifics as to how they would deal with this and how they would deal with that. But they do recognize the redefinition of the people of God. And so they may put that under that category. And you see, it's the redefinition of the people of God which I think is foundational for if they would just expand on that, I think they would maybe come to different conclusions. The redefinition of the people of God should raise questions concerning the application of Israelite civil law. Israel was a theocracy. In the theocracy, the civil government enforces the religious laws. We no longer want to establish a theocracy. As God's people, the church, we don't want to establish a theocracy. There's legitimacy to the separation of church and state. And when they look at theocratic Israel and the civil laws, they look to the modern state as an analog. And I think we should look at a different analog. And we'll argue in a particular example a little bit later how some of the civil penalties were applied in the New Testament. And so I do think there are principles in the civil law. We'll talk about some of those principles of righteousness that we would hope our civil government would exemplify. But it's not about taking the penalties of the law and trying to apply them necessarily in modern government today. Well, we come to talk about a view of the law that Poynthrus develops and that I want to present before you called the Christocentric view. Another term that's being bandied about today is Christotelic. Christ is the goal of the law. Sort of set the stage, give us a framework related to the law. First of all, the law is directly related to the concept of the covenant. Covenant precedes law. The law is given to a redeemed people, and God makes a covenant with them, redeems them, and then gives the law. And the function of the law in a covenant has several functions, but one is to maintain the covenant relationship. How does God want his people to live? And so the law is given to help God's people live in liberty in a way that's pleasing to God. We should not look at the law as something which is an imposition, but it's like a train. You put a train out in the middle of the street, and it's not going to go anywhere. A lot of freedom out in the middle of the street, but you put the train on tracks, and then the train really goes because it was made to run on those tracks. And so, in much the same way, God has created us, and partly his law is for our benefit. Now, there's also unity and diversity of the law in different covenant context. It's important to understand the law within the covenant context, especially sort of redemptive historical. There was a law before Moses. It's not very explicit exactly what it was. The Westminster Confession of Faith says God gave to Adam a law as a covenant of works. And certainly we see in Genesis 2, God gave to Adam a command. And we read through Genesis and Genesis 4:10, we get the idea that murder is wrong. And so God must have told Adam some of these basics of the law, and they were passed down. Interesting, it says in Genesis 26, 4 and 5, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. That phraseology, my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, is picked up in Deuteronomy 11:1, where it says, therefore you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. So, Abraham is represented as a lawkeeper. Now, we don't know the specifics of the law that he had, but he is an example of someone who lives in obedience to what God has revealed to him. The law before Moses is not always identical to the law after Moses, or at least the law that comes in the Mosaic Covenant brings some changes in terms of some things that may have gone before. That's why you have to understand the law within its covenantal context. In other words, the example we've already referred to in an earlier lecture, can you marry your half-sister? Well, Abraham did. And yet, the laws in Leviticus would say that you can now no longer marry your half-sister. So there is some development there, at least in relationship to that issue. There may even be some development between Exodus and the giving of the law and Deuteronomy because of the changed situation that God's people face. So there might be some development that you see in the law throughout the Old Testament. However, there's also a unity to the law. And I do believe you can argue, in fact, I believe the Old Testament makes this argument, that there are distinctions among the law and that priority is given to the Ten Commandments. And I'm going to lay out just several things here that I think sort of make that case from the Old Testament standpoint. There is a clear difference between the Ten Commandments and the rest of the laws. The Ten Commandments and the Covenant Code, if you want to call it that. The Ten Commandments are absolute statements. The technical term for that is apodictic statements. Statements of what should or should not be. You know, thou shalt not. That's an absolute statement. The other laws are conditional, casuistic is the technical term. Many times they begin with if this happens or when this happens. And so the two types of law are different. The Ten Commandments are called the Ten Words and are identified with the covenant. The other law is called judgments, mishpat in the Hebrew, judgments. And many people refer to these as case law. Sort of taking the Ten Commandments and how do they work out in society. The Ten Commandments have no social context. And there are no fines or punishments related to the Ten Commandments. But the other laws of the Old Testament do have a social context, and they reflect that social context, and they have fines and punishments connected to them. The Ten Commandments came to Israel directly and personally, as we saw, written by the finger of God, while the covenant code, the other laws, come through Moses, mediated more through Moses. So I do believe the Old Testament itself makes the case for the priority of the Ten Commandments. And I do think you can see unity in the Old Testament and even into the New Testament related to the Ten Commandments. Now, that doesn't mean that that there's not an advancement in some ways, even in relationship to the Ten Commandments with the coming of Jesus. We've already mentioned the Sabbath commandment. We don't worship on Saturday because of the resurrection on the first day of the week. And so there may be some of those minor adjustments, but that doesn't take away from the unity that is there. And so the Ten Commandments are very basic and vital throughout all of Scripture. Now I want to come to the place in your notes where it says traditional names for the types of law, moral, civil, and ceremonial. So find that place. Basically, the Christocentric view of the law overlaps significantly with the traditional Reformed understanding of the law. We're just going to tweak it a little bit. And the traditional Reformed understanding usually divides the law into moral, civil, and ceremonial categories, with the moral law being the Ten Commandments, the civil law being the judicial law. And the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 19:4, talks about the general equity related to the civil law, that there are principles of justice and righteousness that may be very relevant for God's people today. And then there's the ceremonial law, law that relates to the rituals and types of the Old Testament, that many of them are fulfilled directly in the work of Jesus Christ. Now, I believe this distinction, moral, ceremonial, and civil, is a good distinction. I think it's an appropriate distinction. It's a helpful distinction. Part of the problem is what people do with it. It's also true that the Old Testament does not always clearly make this distinction. If you read Leviticus 19, you've got all these laws mixed together, and you might even argue that you've got some ceremonial elements even in the Ten Commandments related to the Sabbath, honoring your father and mother,
so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. So these distinctions, I think, are very helpful. But sometimes in the Old Testament, they are mixed together. If you push this distinction too much, and I think what some people do with this distinction, they focus on the moral law because of its relevance for God's people today, and they don't reflect as much on the civil and the ceremonial law and its relevance for God's people today. And the Christocentric view, the Christotelic view, wants to affirm that all of God's law is relevant to God's people today and has something to teach God's people today. Now the question is, how is it relevant? And we will sort of show that in a variety of ways as we work our way through some examples here and then through the book of Leviticus, because we'll have opportunity in Leviticus to sort of reflect on how some of the laws in Leviticus are relevant to God's people today. But certainly the ceremonial law teaches us a lot about our relationship with God. And the civil law may teach us about righteousness and justice. And so I have in your notes, I'm not going to comment specifically, we've already commented on this, the different functions of the law, the first use of the law, the civil use of the law, the second use of the law is a tutor to lead us to Christ, shows us our need of a mediator, and the third use of the law is a guide for the believer. All three of those are important, all three of those are significant, and you really need to be aware of that terminology. It's used quite often in our circles. But let's come to that section that says Christ, the hermeneutical key. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to work through Luke 24. We talk about Luke 24 a little bit more detail in other classes. But in Luke 24, Jesus sort of makes the point that all of the law, all of the Old Testament, is related to him, and that you don't understand the Old Testament unless you understand its relationship to him. And that's the basis of this particular view of the law, so that all of the Old Testament continues in value and relevance because it does reveal and is related to Jesus Christ. The issue is, how do we apply the law? So let's go to that point in your notes where it talks about how we apply the law. This is just before the example of Levirate marriage. So find that place in your notes. There are three things that are important for understanding an Old Testament law. And since you're doing your paper on a law passage, this may be significant. So if you're kind of dozing, you might want to get back into sync with things. Although I have not seen anybody really dozing. So, how do we properly apply the law? Well, first of all, we must understand the law within its Old Testament context. What did that law mean to the nation of Israel? What did that law mean in its Old Testament context? That's foundational. Secondly, how does that law relate to Jesus Christ? What are the implications of the coming of Christ? And we'll talk, when we get to Leviticus, about broad concepts are related to the mission of Israel in the Old Testament, the mission of the church in the New Testament. Sometimes that's a very important consideration. And then thirdly, what does this particular law mean for God's people today? What does it teach God's people today? What are we to learn from that law? You know, we may not have to specifically keep that law. We'll talk about the food laws. But it has has something to teach us. And it has relevance for God's people today. So in approaching the Old Testament law, what did that law mean in its Old Testament context? What are the implications and the connections to Jesus Christ? And once you've worked through that, and you have to talk about what happens when Christ comes, some significant things there, and then what does that law mean to God's people today? Now, I want to work through two examples, and then we'll begin to work our way through Leviticus and come across other examples that we'll sort of reflect about these things. The first example I want to take is the example of Levirate marriage. This comes in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10. We briefly talked about Levirate marriage in relationship to Judah and Tamar. But here God gives some regulations related to Levirate marriage. Probably be good if I read this section just to get it in front of us. So Deuteronomy 25:5. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. Now, what's the purpose of this particular law in the Old Testament? Well, it was to ensure that if a man died before he produced a male heir, his name would continue. So if you have brother A and brother B, normally brother A would marry and produce sons, and the firstborn son would continue on the name of the father and would receive the inheritance of the father. And brother B, same thing. He would have children, a son. The son would carry on the name of his father and would receive the inheritance. If brother A dies before he has produced a son, brother B has the obligation to take the wife of brother A and raise up a son, and that son then would take and carry on the name of brother A and would receive the inheritance of brother A. That's Levirate marriage. Some of the issues that are significant here: be fruitful and multiply. Perhaps there's some protection related to the widow. But the most important thing is to raise up a seed for future posterity. And you have several concepts that are very significant and that are usually related together. The concept of seed, the concept of a name, the concept of inheritance. Those things are tied together in the Old Testament. And in a redemptive historical sense, what Brother B does is raise to life a dead line. And that's very significant in the context of the Old Testament. It keeps alive the family line. And you wonder if there are not if there is not significance attached to this. These things are significant in the Old Testament because in the Old Testament, these lines are significant. And part of that is because of messianic implications. And so even though Brother B is not obligated to do this, he doesn't have to, there is a ceremony here that sort of chains him a little bit if he is not willing to take upon himself this responsibility. So in the Old Testament, an arrangement like this would not fall under adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery. This type of an arrangement would not fall under the category of adultery. Now, what are the implications of Christ's coming? Well, he's the fulfillment of the seed idea. Inheritance issues are different. Their inheritance was the land that was passed down from generation to generation. And I've already mentioned this, that land concept is expanded now in the New Covenant to include the cosmos, the world, Romans 4:13, and ultimately our inheritance is the new heavens and new earth. And so things that are connected together in the Old Testament, and part of that relates to the whole concept of a theocracy, now with the coming of Jesus Christ, are no longer connected in the same way. And so you've got, with the coming of Jesus Christ, this now but not yet perspective that you have to take into consideration related to the kingdom of God. The fact that it's here now. It's here in a spiritual sense. It has implications for everything else, but it's here in a spiritual sense. It will not yet come in its fullness until Jesus Christ comes back. And so in one sense, Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden was a theocracy. Israel was a theocracy. And the new heavens and the new earth will be a theocracy. And in the theocracy, all of these things are connected together, pointing us forward ultimately to the coming of Jesus Christ. And so now, family connections are different. Remember Jesus' teaching? And somebody comes to him and says, oh, your mother and your brothers are outside. What does he say? Who are my mothers and my brothers? There's a different relationship now, focusing on Jesus Christ. So that in some contexts, you make a commitment of faith in Jesus Christ, you may be disenfranchised by your family. But you're given a new family, brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ. The whole concept of adoption comes into its fullness much more in the New Testament. And so this is what we're talking about. understanding the important concepts of a particular law in the Old Testament. What is the purpose of these laws? The significance of the coming of Christ to these concepts. The significance of the now but not yet situation that we are in because of the first and second coming of Christ. He didn't do everything at once, which was sort of the Old Testament perspective. When God comes, he would both save his people and judge the enemies, and that would be it. But that's not the way it works out, first coming, second coming. And ultimately, then, the new heavens and the new earth, you have to factor in there. So that if you're an elder and someone in your church comes to you and they want to do Levirate marriage, no, you can't do that now, okay? It's adultery now. It had its place and its purpose within Israel as a theocracy because of all these concepts and what this was teaching, but now that Christ has come, we no longer do Levirate marriage, but Levirate marriage has a lot to teach us related to these concepts. And so all the law is relevant. All the law has something to teach God's people, even if we may not now follow the specific regulation. All right? Let's look at our second example. And this comes from Deuteronomy 17. And this does relate to the penalties of the Old Testament law. So let's look at Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 through 7. Again, it's probably helpful to read this section. If there is found among you, within any of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, a man or woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God in transgressing his covenant, who has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the hosts of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it is told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently. And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has committed that wicked thing, and shall stone to death that man or woman with stones. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. So you shall put away the evil from among you. Now this passage commands the death penalty for apostasy, for worshiping God in a way, or for worshiping other gods, mentioned in verse 3, the sun, the moon, or the host of heaven, which I have not commanded. So if anyone within Israel is discovered worshiping other gods, they were to be stoned to death. The purpose of that is to purge the evil from the community. God is the only one who is worthy of worship. And within the theocracy of Israel, he was the only one to be worshipped. And so if anybody else is found worshiping other gods, then they were to be stoned to death. Now, what's the implications of the coming of Christ? Well, we've talked about the fact that Israel is a theocracy, so that the civil law reinforces the religious law. And now with the coming of Jesus Christ, and as a part of our mission, as God's people, we are not trying to establish a theocracy. There is the legitimate separation of church and state. Each of those has their own function. And part of this comes from Jesus' statement, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom was of this world, my servants would be picking up the sword. We don't advance the kingdom of Christ through the sword. The state government can use the sword in certain ways to defend its citizens, capital punishment. I would say those are legitimate ways that civil government can use the sword. And so we're not looking to establish a theocracy. We're not looking to put to death people who are false worshipers. See, in Israel, it was a theocracy. Everybody within the land of Israel was, part of the mission of Israel was to live in obedience to God's law, and the Gentiles would be drawn to Israel. We'll talk more about that in Leviticus. But our mission is to go out into the world. We go out into a variety of nations, a variety of governments, a variety of cultures, different cultures. We go out into the world with the good news of the gospel, and we are willing to die for the good news of the gospel. We don't pick up the sword to further the good news of the gospel. And so the analog to Israel is not the modern state or modern government. The analog to Israel is the church. And so when we read about this penalty in Deuteronomy 17 of a person being stoned to death because they're worshiping false gods, we look to the New Testament to help us see what the New Testament does with these penalties. And the principle, if you look closely, is very much the same in 1 Corinthians 5. Paul is dealing with a certain situation in the church at Corinth, a situation where church discipline needs to be carried out. And Deuteronomy 17:7, where it says, "So you shall put away the evil from among you," is quoted. It's not an allusion. I may not have put that in your notes. I probably should put that in your notes. In my notes, I've got Deuteronomy 17:7 from the Septuagint and 1 Corinthians 5:13, and they are identical. And so Paul in 1 Corinthians 5:13 says, "Put away from yourselves the evil person." The principle is the same. If someone within the covenant community is now worshiping another god or is living in a way that is displeasing to God, and the example in 1 Corinthians 5 is an example of sexual immorality, church discipline should be exercised. And Matthew 18 sort of lays out steps for church discipline. The outcome of church discipline might be, there's no repentance, that the person is removed from the covenant community. Remove the evil from your midst. The principle is the same. God's covenant community must remain pure. But we don't put to death covenant breakers within the church. We admonish, and in some situations, we may need to institute discipline, which might lead to a person being removed from the covenant community. The principle is the same. It's just worked out a little bit different because now we are not a theocracy. The church is different in that regard. Now, when we come to the new heavens and new earth, there won't be the need for church discipline because only those in the new heavens and new earth will be those who are part of the covenant community. We live in a fallen world. And people make a profession of faith. We don't always know for sure if it's of the heart. We examine a profession of faith, and a person looks like they're living for the Lord. We receive them into the church. And sometimes time passes, and it might become evident that maybe they are some of the seed that falls on ground and springs up for a while and then is choked out. So you can see that how Deuteronomy 17 is picked up by Paul in the New Testament. It has something very much to say to God's people today. You might also reflect about some of the principles here related to putting someone to death and how they might relate to capital punishment. I think there's some, there might be some things there that would be helpful as well. So where an Old Testament passage is operating in a theocratic situation, there may be things then that you would separate out when you come to look at its significance within the pages of the New Testament. Questions? Yes, sir.
Now, does the Old Testament, it's an exclusivism in the sense that Israel is to keep themselves apart. The New Testament,
yes, sir,
is a, the church is to be in the world, but not on,
yes,
the world. And there's the command to go and all that.
That's right.
And then even in the back, in the passage, you use the First Corinthians 5:13, the whole, there is, besides the purpose that you have in Deuteronomy 17:7, there's an added purpose now that could be done in Deuteronomy 17:7. Because when you get the second Corinthians, it's a love. This was used to redeem that person back.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And should always be maybe talk about church discipline. It's the purpose is to restore. That's what you hope. You hope happens. Yes.
This verse, but then it's just,
yes,
just now because of the new, we can restore it.
Yes, very much so. And the point you raise about the mission of the church is an excellent point. We're going to develop that in relationship to the food laws, and talk about Israel in the Old Testament and now our mission in the New Testament in relationship to the food laws. But that is that's a good point. All right, what I want to do now, the rest of your notes is just sort of an exposition of the Ten Commandments as a guide to the believer. And I did a seminar at one point on this, and I've just sort of given you some of my basic notes related to that seminar. We're not going to go through it. But there's an interesting principle in the larger catechism. And the larger catechism goes through the Ten Commandments. And the principle is, if something is forbidden in the commandment, it's appropriate to ask what is positively commanded. And the larger catechism does that. And I've done that a little bit, reflecting on these commandments as I've worked through the Ten Commandments here. So I don't want to take the time to go through this. This is just given to you for your benefit, if it's of any use to you. So we are finished, in essence, with lecture 16.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.